Wednesday, June 21st, 2017, you are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, sports writer from Denver, Colorado. You know, we talk sports every single Wednesday, and we like to hit the biggest sports stories, but we try to look at them with a dose of common sense. You know, we've been accused in the past of being more of a thinking person's sports talk show, and we kind of pride ourselves on that. Now, there are a couple of ways that you can keep up with or contact the Daily Dose. You can go check out new articles and a link to the podcast every single week if you just head over to dailydosesports.wordpress.com. In fact, this week, of course, there was some big news, came out last week when the Floyd Mayweather versus Conor McGregor fight is going to be taking place in August out in Las Vegas. I'll be honest with you, I'm not a huge fan of this fight. Boxing has enough credibility issues without having a farce of a fight that is just going to anger people. It already has enough problems. We don't need to add that to it. But this week, the Daily Dose was able to break some news about the undercard of that fight. I'm not sure if you've heard about the undercard, but you might want to go check that article out over at dailydosesports.wordpress.com. It's pretty interesting. Make sure you stop by and check that out. If you've got a question, you've got a comment, maybe you need some advice. We do have our email show coming in just a few weeks. It won't be long. Hit us up on email. Send your email to us at dailydosesports@gmail.com. You can also find us over on Twitter or Facebook. Both of those handles are at Daily Dose Sports. Now, today on the show, the second half of our interview with high school basketball coach Russ McKinstry. If you didn't hear the first half of this interview, I encourage you, go back and listen to episode 133. Coach Mack discusses his career, some of the best players that he's coached and coached against. He does also discuss his battle with cancer and how he had to game plan to beat that horrible disease. But today, we will also discuss some of his thoughts on basketball today and what advice he would give to parents as their kids start to get involved in athletics, and also whether or not he thinks LeBron James should be in the conversation for greatest basketball player of all time. I'm telling you right now, you do not want to miss the second half of this interview. But first, the 2017 NBA draft is going to be taking place tomorrow night in Brooklyn. Of course, the Philadelphia 76ers made that trade with Boston to go get the top pick, and speculation is that they're going to be taking Washington point guard Markelle Fultz. I have a few concerns about Fultz. Told you in the past, he didn't win. Is the biggest thing. When there's only five guys on the floor, I kind of want to see a couple of victories. But he's a talented kid. I understand it. The Celtics made that trade and got more draft choices. You know, Boston is either stocking up for a big move, or Danny Ainge just figures more picks means job security. Like, actually picking players that could turn into busts might get you fired. But just keep buying lottery tickets. It doesn't matter if you win the lottery. You just act like this one might be the winner. Hey, I'm telling you, I might have the winner right here. Just wait. We just have to wait and see. This could be the winner. He just keeps stockpiling those picks. See what Boston does. I think the Los Angeles Lakers probably take Lonzo Ball at number two. I've told you he has a long way to go, but I do like Kansas freshman Josh Jackson. He's a smart kid. He plays pretty hard. I still like his upside possibly more than anyone else here. We'll see where he ends up. Here's my question, though. As we go into the draft on Thursday night, are we going to see those big name veterans move on draft night? Already starting to hear some rumors. The Indiana Pacers, the Los Angeles Lakers, talking about Paul George maybe moving. There's a few players with expiring contracts that could move. What about guys like Jimmy Butler, Blake Griffin, Kevin Love, Carmelo Anthony, Boogie Cousins, Gordon Hayward? What about Chris Paul? Could he get moved? Paul Millsap down at Atlanta. All these guys could be shopped around. I know that draft nights rarely live up to the hype.
Don't believe the hype.
But there are some deals out there that could be made. And we might see a few of these players move around on draft night. Some of these teams would be well advised to make these moves now instead of waiting until later. Getting some of these players might be a good deal. Say the Lakers get Paul George. Is that a good plan? How does that look going forward? Because let's say the Lakers go like 24 and 58 next year. His deal is expiring. You have 1 year to get him to stay a Laker. Let's say they struggle next year. Think he's sticking around? Or does he leave and say, eh, I don't know, actually Boston seems like a better deal. You know, they're going to the playoffs. They're trying to challenge Cleveland. Trying to do some things. Maybe I'd rather just go to Boston. So sometimes some of these teams might be rooting for a team like the Lakers to get Paul George And then if they struggle, hey, maybe the next year we'd have a shot at him. Whereas if he goes to Boston this year, they kind of know they're out of the running. It's going to be interesting to see what some of these teams do. Few players that could get moved around on draft night. One team that has got to be feeling better about whatever they do in this draft is the Los Angeles Clippers, who somehow got NBA resident genius Jerry West to join their front office as an advisor. We talked about this a few weeks ago. Didn't sound like Jerry had any interest. Now suddenly he is going to the Clippers. Now here's the thing. Little advice to the Clippers. I don't care what Jerry West says. I don't care if he says, let's trade like Blake Griffin and Chris Paul to Orlando for two tickets to the Magic Kingdom. You do it. Because Jerry West has forgotten more basketball than that dreadful franchise in Los Angeles has ever known. I don't care what he says. You just do it. Every single time, you do whatever deal he wants. Draft night's going to be interesting. Next week, of course, we will be talking about the NBA draft and recapping some of the bigger moves. Speaking of smart guys, we are going to be coming back with Colorado high school basketball coach Russ McKinstry. Talk a little bit more about his coaching career, and we are going to get his thoughts on the game today. You do not want to miss that.
Dear podcast listener, we accept the fact that we have to sacrifice not only our Wednesdays, but our Fridays as well to entertain you. But we think you are crazy to make us do a promo telling you who we think we are. When you listen to our podcast, you think you know who we are, in the simplest terms, in the most convenient definitions. But what we found out is that each one of us is a dork.
I had the basket case,
and I'm a princess,
and I'm a pothead.
Does that answer your question? Sincerely yours, The Prime Podcast. Find out more at theprimepod.com. Think of the tender
things that we were working on. Movies, anime, comics, video games, and pop culture. These are but mere playthings for the manliest beings in all of podcasting history, the powerful Nerdcast. Hosted by the gurus of geekdom, Corey and Christian, join them each week to discuss all things nerd culture, everything from Star Wars to Dragon Ball Z, and everything in between. Find the powerful Nerdcast on the Rogue Intel Podcast Network at rogueintel.com.
Coach, you ended up coming back to Colorado. You got your health back. You had a couple of quick stops, but you ended up going back to Lewis Palmer for a second time and just blew up down there. I mean, what a run you guys went on down at LP.
Yeah, I was so fortunate. Again, one of my my close friends, and you know him, his name's John Borman. He actually was one of my assistant coaches at Greeley Central. He ended up progressing through the educational ranks and became a principal. And he was at Lewis Palmer. And after I had got through all the health scares and spent a couple of years getting back into the game of basketball, he said, hey, why don't you come down and take over this program? And we need an athletic director as well, so you can be AD and run the basketball program. And that doesn't happen very often in the high school ranks, where you get to be both the athletic director and a coach. So basically you get to be your own boss. And I couldn't pass that opportunity up. So, and again, my past experience with Lewis Palmer was so positive that, it was pretty much a no-brainer. So yeah, I went back to Lewis Palmer and we did. We had just the most fantastic role and went to five straight Final Fours and won back-to-back state championships there. And they're really, the kids there are my type of kids. They're hard workers. They're humble. They're eager to learn, very coachable. And, you know, they have great parent support, but the parent support is realistic. It's not, their expectations aren't over the top for what they really think their kids are capable of doing. And they understand the value of hard work and discipline. So it's a perfect match. It was a perfect match for me. I think it was a perfect match for the kids. And we did. It was just such a remarkable run. I had so much fun. It was a great 5-year run.
Coach, one thing about your career that you've consistently done, and we've talked about it a little bit today, but you've consistently taken schools that don't necessarily have that tradition of winning, and you've turned them into winners. It's tough. It's really, really difficult to change a losing mentality. Is there one specific thing you target and say, if we can get this, we can kind of get over the hump? Is there something that you specifically go after to try to change that mentality?
Well, I think there's a few things, and you were a part of it, Clint, as you know. first of all, you have to hire great assistant coaches because, again, going back to even my cancer story, you cannot do this alone. So you have to surround yourself with good people. And I've been fortunate to have people like yourself and other great assistant coaches. So first and foremost, you can't be afraid to go out and get people that are smart and maybe think differently than you and utilize their strengths and talents to help you establish a new culture. But I think two words really sum it up, trust and communication. You've got to get the players to trust you, know that you're there for them. It's not about you. You know, they understand that they're not pawns being utilized to advance your career and your ego, and it's all about winning for the sake of the coach. They really get that you love and care about them as people. And as long as they're good people and, you know, conduct themselves with honesty and integrity, then they'll go through a wall for you. You know, they'll just play so hard for you. And then the second thing is communication, just being honest and open and letting them be honest and open with you. So, you know, you can get through any issues that, you know, maybe you have to overcome as a team, and every team does have issues. But if you can be honest with each other and they feel comfortable communicating really what they're feeling about their experience, then I think you can kind of change that culture from, you know, lacking confidence or, you know, being jealous of other players and worrying about playing time and worrying about stats. Get them past that to where they just really start to care about each other and making sure that they're going to have each other's backs, then I think you've got something special that you can do with kids.
What do you think is tougher? Because you've done it both ways. Do you think it's harder to change that constant loser into a winner? Or do you think it's tougher to stay on top once you've got there? Because you did, like you mentioned, you won back-to-back titles in 2012 and 2013. But you've got to fight against both players and, you know, the supporters and parents being satisfied with, hey, we've already won it. What more do you want from us? Which is tougher?
I would say probably just changing the culture.
Yeah.
I think that is probably the most difficult thing to do in coaching because it's so entrenched. And there's just, you know, until you can get over that mental hump where they really do believe that, hey, this is something we can do, that's very difficult. And, you know, I think a lot of coaches leave coaching or they get burned out because they just can't quite find that trigger point to get them over that mental hump. You know, more than anything, it's a mental hump.
Right.
So I would say that's more difficult. But, you know, the nice thing about once you start to experience success, again, trust and confidence and communication, then you've got something special, especially trust and confidence. You know, when you throw in the level of confidence that kids develop when they take the court and they know they deserve to win, they know they deserve success because they know they're working harder than their opponent. They know they've paid their dues. They've made the sacrifices. They know they don't have to worry about personal agendas. They've got that figured out because their personal agendas will be rewarded and satisfied because of the team's success. So I think confidence and trust, once you start to win, you know, like the San Antonio Spurs and what Golden State has going now at the NBA level and, you know, what Duke, Kentucky, North Carolina have every year, you know, at the collegiate level, it's just that confidence level. They just know that they're better because they're more prepared. They've worked harder. And, you know, when you have that kind of swagger and that positive vibe, that's really something hard to defeat.
Coach, I'm going to put you on the spot here. I'm going to ask you a couple things. We're going to see how sharp that memory is, but I'm going to ask you a couple of specific things, and let's see if you can pull these out. You coached for what, 30 years, so, somewhere in that vicinity?
Yeah, so close to 30 years, yep.
Okay. You were never a coach that got too excited about officiating. You weren't a guy that was too demonstrative on the sideline. How many technicals did you get in your career, would you say?
I know exactly how many I got, and I can tell you exactly.
Do you really?
Years. Yeah. 1985, my first year as a head coach, I got one technical.
For what?
And then, and I was stupid. Again, I told you I was arrogant, thought I was really hot stuff as a first-year coach. I was coaching probably my third game ever as a high school coach. And I was really upset with a referee who I felt was making a lot of hometown calls. We were on the road.
Okay.
So I told one of my players to go pretend like he was guarding that official. And, you know, just like the official had a ball. And this player did that for me. And the referee you know, came by after about a minute that said, what in the heck is going on? What's wrong with this kid? Is, you know, is he mentally challenged or what's going on? I said, no, he's doing exactly what he's told. I told him to do. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I told him to go guard the other team's best player. And that was my first technical.
No, so, that's going to get you teed up right there.
Yeah, I got me teed up. And I think word spread throughout Kansas about my little arrogant antic. And I don't think I got a call the rest of the year that first year because of that brashness. So I kind of learned my lesson there.
Sure.
And then I also got one. I think it was 1995 was my second and last one. So, and that was, I got a little bit too excited and ran out on the court during a game and kind of was in the way of the play. And again, it was just out of excitement and I got teed up for that. But those were the only two I got.
You had two technicals in 30 some years of coaching?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that was it.
I almost got you one. Yep. Do you remember when I almost got you a technical?
I do. Yes, I do.
I think we were at maybe Columbine. And
I think it was.
We go down to one end, take a shot, get some body, no call. They go down to the other end, get some body, and they make the call. And all I said was, I said, hey, can you call it the same at both ends? And the ref turned around and said, did you just say that? And you said, yeah, I did. And he said, okay, because if your assistant said it, I'm teeing you up. And you said, no, I said it. And he said, okay, and he turned around and walked away, and you walked over to me and said, hey, what did I say?
I do remember that.
I could have got you your third right there.
Could have got my third, yep.
Now, I'm assuming, and I don't know this, I'm assuming the best wins of your career were those state championship games, but maybe I'm wrong. Is there a game that stands out to you as like the best win that you ever had?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I think the state championship games would have to, especially the first one.
Yeah.
The first one was really, you know, when you wait so long. I played or coached in one other state championship game, like I said, in Kansas. And we lost that one by 7 and probably should have won it. So, you know, that happened in my third year as a head coach. And then I waited, you know, 22 more years before I got my second chance to coach at a state championship game. So
wow.
After that much time, you start to really wonder, you know, you're right there in the hop, but you just can't get across the threshold and bring home the big one. So that was huge, that first state championship. And it was such a special group and they've worked so hard. And that was really special. But I would also have to say that maybe the most rewarding was, again, going back to that time where Smoky Hill beat Cherry Creek, because I think Smoky Hill had been beat 14 straight years, 2 times. So I think they had lost maybe 27 straight games to Cherry Creek. And we were kind of the ugly stepchild and the one that Cherry Creek really looked down on. And really, they didn't really give us any type of respect at all. And so when we, after getting beat by 30-some, come back and beat them, that, I think it was such a huge win for Smoky Hill and that school that it really not only changed the culture in basketball, but it had ramifications with all the athletic programs. And actually from that point on, from then until about maybe 2003 or 2004, Smoky Hill had success in all kinds of sports. And I think, not to take too much credit, but I really do believe that bunch with that win finally let people know, like Cherry Creek and, you know, Mullen, that, hey, we're not going to take a back seat anymore, that we can compete with you guys. So I'm kind of really proud of that win.
Sure. No, that's understandable. I know we talked a little bit about some of the best players that you've coached, and you've got a nice list there. But what about some of the players that you coached against? Who are some of the best players, best maybe some names that we'd even recognize of players that you coached against through all your years of coaching?
Oh, there's been some really good players. Like I said, Michael Ruffin from Creek, who played in the NBA. Lewis Amundson, who up until last year was still playing in the NBA. He played at Boulder. You know, Eddie Gill, who played at Overland, who ended up playing in the NBA. A lot of the kids that came out of the Palmer program down in Colorado Springs, Ted Kritza, who went on and played at New Orleans, Wesley Gordon, who was at Sierra and ended up playing with Josh Guy at the University of Colorado. Yeah, I guess I could go on and on with some of the outstanding kids that I got to coach against. There's just so many of them. I probably wouldn't do, you know, it justice if I kept on going, because there's so many good ones that I probably have left out. But I've seen a lot of good players, and Colorado isn't known, obviously, for its high school basketball, but I think if people really took the time to really look at the players that have come out of Colorado, They might be shocked at some of the talented kids that have really played in Colorado. And, you know, once they leave Colorado, because the collegiate basketball scene in Colorado has always been so bad, that they go off to other places and sure. play, and people kind of lose track of their careers. But I think if Colorado wasn't such a ski, snowboarding, you know, professional Denver Bronco type state, I think people realize that, yeah, there's been a lot of really good basketball players come through the state of Colorado.
Well, and like you said, Colorado's not that known for basketball, but there's also been some right. really great coaches that have come out of this state too.
Yeah, one thing that always was emphasized whenever I was, you know, helping kids being recruited by colleges around the country was the fact that college coaches looked at Colorado this way. They said, hey, you know what, your talent level maybe isn't that great, but the level of coaching in Colorado is some of the best coaching going on in the 50 states. I mean, you guys have incredible coaches in the state of Colorado. And, you know, that's why we got to kind of be careful when we recruit your kids out of Colorado, because you coach them up so much that sometimes maybe they're being recruited at a higher level when really they're just being coached extremely well. So they were always a little bit, you know, leery about Colorado kids because they weren't sure if it was the coaching or if it was actually the skill level of the kids. So that always made me feel good about our coaches. And it's a really big coaching fraternity. And yeah, I could, you know, some of the coaches that have come out of Colorado are obviously really top-notch high school coaches.
Like I said, you're currently a district athletic director. I got to ask you, any thoughts of getting back into coaching? Are you done? Are you thinking about going back and doing anything more, or what do you got going?
You know, I actually think about it probably every day playing.
Do you?
I miss, there's so much I miss about. There's one thing that I don't miss. It just makes me pause a little bit. It's maybe a weird or strange statement, but I don't miss the games that much, but I miss the process. I miss the journey. I really miss teaching the game at practice. I really miss the off season where you're grinding and you're weightlifting and you're conditioning and you're trying to figure out who you are as a team and you're working with your assistant coaches and you're heading off to summer camps and summer leagues. I just miss that horribly. And if there's anything that would draw me back into it, it's just I miss that part of basketball and teaching the game so much. So I'm not going to say for sure that I'm done, because I still have a desire to do this again. So we'll see what happens down the road. It wouldn't surprise me if I get back into it and start it, you know, all over again, because I still have that passion. But also, I'm not going to take just anything. It has to be the right situation.
Well, and the things that you talked about, the portions of it that you missed are also those portions of it where you do build the relationships with the players. And the yes. games, as I guess exciting, and you get the adrenaline going in the games and that kind of thing. The games, you don't have that same situation. Yes, sometimes there's teaching moments, but for the most part, it's kind of the equivalent of a teacher handing out the tests and saying, okay, what do you know? You don't get to have that interaction as much with the players, and you also get a lot of interaction with other people in the stands and parents and those kind of things. So I was always the same way, where I was like, you know, I don't miss the game so much. I miss the day-to-day practice and the grind and the teaching kind of stuff. The games, as bizarre as it sounds, they're kind of a necessary evil from my perspective.
Yeah, right. And I know you've got a very extensive coaching background too, and you were a head coach, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, game night is for the players, and it should be. I mean, that's right. that's their time to shine and have fun. And, you know, coaches who go in and try and take over game night, I don't have much respect for, because really that's when you do turn it over to the players and, you know, you assist them through the process. That's your role, but it should be all about the players on game night. You know, that's why maybe I don't miss it as much, because, you know, my role shouldn't be that intentional during a game situation. It's up for the players to shine. So, but yeah, the rest of the process, as you know, is, you know, special when you get to go on scouting trips with your assistant coaches. And as you know, in our programs, we would always travel out of state and go to team camps across the United States and try and show our kids the other side of the basketball community, you know, and take them to special places to see basketball from other states' perspective. And I really, really miss that process a lot.
One thing that I learned from you in coaching with you, so many people think of coaching as being this motivational thing where you've got to go out and you've got to motivate kids. Not that you didn't motivate, but you always taught that coaching was more 90% teaching and then the 10% motivation. And so many coaches, and I think especially young coaches, they kind of reverse that and they have the 90% motivation. And maybe it's just because they don't have the knowledge base to be a good teacher, but so much of what you did and so much of the programs you ran, it was a teaching mentality. It wasn't this rah-rah emotional motivation kind of stuff. It was core teaching fundamental things. And that was the one of the biggest things that I always took from your programs.
Well, thanks. And that was a process for me too, because when I came out as a coach, I think, you know, you revert to maybe I don't have the substance, but I sure have the work ethic and energy. So I'll utilize that as my strength. And then as you really start to figure out what coaching is, which it really is, it's just teaching, you know, it's, you have to be an excellent teacher to be a great head coach. Once you start to figure out, and through wisdom and experience and trial and error, you do finally figure out that it's a lot more about day-to-day relationships and making sure players are confident. And it's about their mindset, and it's about how they're feeling, and not really a whole lot to do with you and your ego and your desire to win and to make a name for yourself. And once you get past that, you know, initial part where you're trying to prove yourself as a coach, and now really what all that matters to you is, are your players having a positive experience? Are they improving? Are they confident? Do they have a passion and a joy for the game? Once you feel comfortable in providing that to the players, then really coaching becomes a whole lot funner.
Coach, it's been a big story, obviously, this year in sports and, I don't know, entertainment, whatever, to see a parent like a LeVar Ball be so involved with his kids' athletic careers. I think he's a little misguided at times. I'm not going to totally kill the guy, because at least he is involved with his kids' lives, and there's a million kids out there that wish they had a LeVar Ball as a dad that actually did pay attention. But how did you deal with difficult parents? You did this for so long. I'm sure you had to deal with it. You probably still have to deal with that today, even now.
Yeah, that's a big part of my job. And to be honest with you, Clint, for the first maybe 10 to 15 years of my career, I hated it. I was not comfortable with it. All I wanted to do was try and isolate myself and my players and my coaches away from parents, you know, and just let me do my job. And communication lines, I know they had to be there and they had to be open, but I wanted it to be as minimal as possible. And that's kind of the way I was raised as a coach too. And that was the mentality from the 70s and 80s, when, you know, when coaches would say, hey, you know what, don't bother me as a head coach, and you have no right to be a part of the program. And about, you know, 15 to 17 years into my coaching career, I finally figured out that that just wasn't the best way to coach, that parents need to feel like they're a partnership in this process. They need to be communicated with. And as frustrating as it may be, when you really boiled it down, you basically usually ended up with maybe two or three parents that just really didn't get athletics and maybe caused you a lot of stress. But once I figured out that, you know, once you could kind of align your expectations as a coach with their expectations as a parent, and you were willing to communicate about those expectations, then you could really, you know, have some good relationships with parents and really start to use them in a positive way to benefit your program. So it was a maturity thing for me. It was a process where I had to learn to become comfortable with myself as a coach and, you know, my confidence as a coach, to be honest with you, and let them to also be a part of the program and feel like, you know, they weren't a threat to me or my players or my program, and that they were actually, you know, basically equal partners in the process. And once I got to that point, then, you know, I actually found it to be enjoyable to work with parents.
If you had to give some advice to some of these parents that are out there, maybe there's parents out there that are listening, maybe they've got young kids just getting into sports, they're just getting into middle school sports, they're just getting into youth league sports, those kind of things. If you had any advice, you've seen it basically from every different side. You've seen it as a player, as a coach, as an administrator, all these different sides. What advice would you give these parents for dealing with their kids as they come through athletics now?
Well, first of all, and you hear it all the time, don't live through them. It's their experience. It's their life. Don't try and recreate things that maybe you wanted to see happen that didn't happen, or things that you want to see happen based on your desires and your wishes as a parent. Let the kid lead, you know, his own life and experience it from his own, you know, desires and wishes and needs and wants. And really, I think the best thing that parents can do is really just let the kids become comfortable being a self-advocate for themselves, don't make them specialize in one sport. That drives me crazy. I think it's the worst thing we do right now as parents is we plug a kid into one certain sport and then we just hammer them year long with that same sport. And by the time they're 13, 14, 15, they're just, you know, they're sick of that sport. You know, they want no part of it anymore. Or if they continue on, they just don't have any passion or joy in the sport, but they're doing it strictly because their parents want them to do it. So if you can teach your kids to be a self-advocate for themselves, to learn to communicate with coaches and ask the right questions of coaches and not be afraid to communicate with coaches, that's only going to parlay into, you know, the work experience when they become adults and they have to fight for their raise with their boss or they have to deal with adversity with their boss and they're able to deal with that situation because they did it all through high school with their coaches. Then you're really teaching them a life skill that's going to benefit them so much. And I, you know, I just encourage parents to not rub the experience into their kids from overcoaching or overanalyzing after game. Don't rehash the game. Just, you know, tell the kid, hey, I really enjoyed watching you play and I love you and can't wait to just see you do it again. And if you just let the kid figure it out on their own, kids are very, very smart. Kids are a lot more mature than we give them credit for. They're very perceptive. They'll figure it out, and that's only going to help them, you know, when they go on to college and then into the workforce.
I'm glad that you brought up the specialization thing because I see more and more youth coaches, parents, everyone saying you got to stick with this one sport. You got to stick with this one sport. You know, if you're going to get a scholarship, you got to stick with this one sport. It drives me absolutely out of my mind. Let them experience different things. Let them utilize different muscle groups. Let them deal with different coaches and different players. It's so healthy for them to go experience those other things.
Yeah, no doubt about it, Clint. It's my biggest pet peeve probably right now is that concept of scholarship-itis.
And yep.
If my kid will just spend his entire waking moments in every aspect of his life focused on becoming a soccer player or basketball or whatever the sport that seems to be their specialty, it just leads to some really dramatic negative experiences. And you always hear the exceptions, like you're talking about the ball kid, okay? That's maybe one out of a million, one
sure.
out of 100,000, whatever. Then it all came together genetically, having the right coaches, and it all worked out perfectly, and now he's going to be a multimillionaire. But there's 999,000 other kids who kind of tried to do the same thing, and they end up just hating the sport, hating their parents, hating life, you know, just miserable in their experience because, you know, of the imbalance in the perspective on what is best for kids and athletically what's best for kids. I mean, if a kid really chooses to do it and it's their choice, more power to them.
Sure.
But as we know, it's usually forced on them by parents who are trying to do right by their kids, but they're actually really hurting, you know, their kids' future athletic endeavors.
You started coaching, like we said, like 30 years ago or something. From then to now, do you think kids are any different?
They're smarter, Clint, yeah. From this perspective. Back when I started and you were around, we all were conditioned to be motivated by how much of a man you were, and everything was based on being challenged as a man.
Right.
And we bought into that, you know. If you weren't physically or mentally tough, then coaches would use sarcasm and challenge your manhood. And we responded to that. Well, nowadays, both boys and girls, they're not stupid enough to buy into that concept. They know better. And I'm so proud that they do. So I think that's the only difference is that they get it. They understand what good coaching is. They understand what being part of a good team is. And they might choose not to do that because of factors, specifically leadership from a poor coach, maybe.
Right.
But they get it. And I don't think maybe when we were growing up, we really got it because we were being fed this line of, you know, the only way you can be successful as an athlete is by, you know, playing on a torn ACL and a fractured wrist. And if we didn't, then there was something wrong with us. And we did. We responded to that. And I think that led to a lot of people my age, maybe your age even too, that became insecure or their vision of what athletics is supposed to be like was really skewed because they were basing everything on this, you know, nebulous challenge of trying to be the toughest biggest, strongest, meanest, bad dude around, which really doesn't have a whole lot to do with success at the athletic choice of sport that you choose.
When you look at some of the coaches right now, and maybe it's high school, maybe it's youth sports, whatever it might be, is there something we're not teaching our kids that you feel like we're missing out on? Is there something that we're kind of missing the boat? Man, we really should be teaching our kids this, and I don't see it consistently enough.
No doubt. I think it's accountability, and accountability goes with handling adversity. I think those two things, I still don't think, and that's something as a district athletic director, I really want to try and get my coaches to understand that we have a tendency, if kids are struggling, to try and make the games easier. We modify games to try and make the game more easily successful for kids.
Sure.
And I think that's teaching them all the wrong things that are really going to benefit them, you know, down the road in their adult lives, and that life isn't going to be perfect every day. In fact, most of the time life is just a grind, and that's why the good times are so enjoyable. Well, I think we still think like we have to make every day perfect for our kids, and that every athletic experience has to be perfect and enjoyable. And we don't take value in, you know, the hard times and the grind and the hard work, not fun, but has to be done, and the dirty work, you know, players that are willing to do dirty work. You know, when I think about the NFL, you watch the tight end position, for example. You know, tight ends don't want to go down and be offensive linemen.
No.
Like, you know, really they should be. They want to be spread out to the hash box so they can work in space and they can catch long balls and be part of getting touchdowns and being an offensive hero. I think you just see that a lot in all aspects of sports, regardless if it's football or basketball or whatever. We're just trying to make things so easy for kids that the hard work, the role of a kid that doesn't have a lot of great stats but is just as important to the process probably isn't being recognized as much as they should be, or validated as much as they should be.
Coach, we've seen the change in the last, I don't know, decade, maybe longer, from high school sports kind of being the pinnacle of youth sports to now seeing club sports starting to completely take over. We've got kids now, they don't even play high school sports. That's not even on their radar. They just play with their club team year round. I see there are certain benefits to that. How do you look at that though?
Yeah,
I also see some drawbacks from it too.
Right. I think there's some positives to the club scene, and I've never been, and you know this about me very well because we've known each other a long time, but I was never really a big advocate or believer in the club scene. But I do see some advantages. I do see some good things going on at club level where player development, skill development is a priority for the clubs, and they hired people that understand how to accomplish that with student athletes of all ages. And I think that's admirable. I still think though the whole scene, the whole process is predicated on promises of scholarships and future success that in no way, shape can be maintained or fulfilled. And I think that's sad to me because people are spending fortunes of money. I mean, they're basically dedicating all of their retirement money, any excess funds that they have, or sometimes funds that they don't even have, to make sure that their kids get into these clubs that the club people are promising them future, you know, scholarship money, and it doesn't pan out. And then the fallback for the clubs is, well, probably why you weren't successful is because you also chose to play high school sports. And if you would have just dedicated yourself to the clubs, then you would have not faced that dilemma, which again is just a very devious way to get a financial system in place for club success,
right,
dedicated on money. So, you know, I do think that clubs have a place. I think we have to partner with them as a high school athletic director and administrator. I think it's here to stay. It's the European model. And the European model, as we know, was around long before our high school model was around. So I think it's just a natural evolution of sports and how sports are viewed and how parents and kids do sports. But I still think if you're honest with most kids, they will not, you know, exchange their experience playing for their high school with their buddies for any other high school experience or college experience at the club level or even a college team, that the best time that they ever had playing sports is with their high school team and their buddies. So I see that message all the time. And then you have the outliers. You have the outliers of the very special kids that maybe are very, very successful at soccer, for example, and are, you know, brought up to the USA national soccer level where they're playing at a very high level, and so they choose not to play high school sports. But that's a very, very rare occurrence. But I think because it happens occasionally here and there, everybody wants to be like that and thinks that's the correct path to take for their kid, but they don't realize that, you know, their kid just, for whatever reason, doesn't have that gift to play at that level. And by the time they realize it, they have skipped their high school opportunities. They're in college and they're looking back extremely frustrated or depressed because they were sold a bill of goods or bought into something that really wasn't realistic. So it works both ways, I think, still.
Coach, looking at the game of basketball specifically, it seems, and it's funny because you see a certain team winning, you see certain teams having success. Basketball and coaches, hey, we're copycats. We all know that. There's always something trending that's kind of the hot new thing. What's the latest thing that you see right now? What's the big thing in basketball that everyone's trying to run right now?
You know, right now, as you can see, it's cyclical. So everybody's going back to good old-fashioned pick-and-roll basketball,
yeah.
Pick and pop. Pick and slide or they're, you know, going to give and go stuff. You know, it's amazing the stuff that kind of came around in the 40s and 50s into the sport that, you know, it became. We're kind of going back to the basic fundamentals. But, you know, I think what Golden State's proven, and I have to admire Golden State for this, is that they really are playing with all the talent they have. They're really making the game be played like a game at the high school level. And what I mean by that is they're saying to NBA players who are used to dictating or forcing a way a game's going to be played based on how hard they want to play on that given night. And Golden State saying, nah, you know what? If you're not willing to kill yourself in defensive transition, we're going to push the ball and we're going to get a wide open three and we're going to make you pay for being lazy in defensive transition. And typically, you know, an NBA team never had to worry about that. They
sure.
didn't have to worry about the fundamentals of defensive transition or defending a pick and roll and pick and pop. You know, they didn't even practice that stuff because it was kind of this unspoken code in the NBA that, hey, this is the NBA and we're only going to work so hard. We're all getting paid lots of money. We're not going to make each other look bad. So we'll kind of play at this pace. We'll kind of do these things. And everybody did the exact same thing. And I think there are a couple of smart people, you know, Steve Kerr for one, and Popovich.
Pop, yeah.
Yeah, they're kind of saying, you know what, guys, if we choose to really play this game the right way, the way it was meant to be played, we can be special. We can set ourselves apart from everybody else because everybody else isn't willing to do the things that we're willing to do. And really all we're doing stuff that they do at the high school level, which is working hard, being fundamentally sound, transitioning hard, and just outworking and outthinking people and making teams adjust to a level that is way out of their comfort zone. So I kind of get a kick watching the Warriors just dominate play because really it's nothing more than having obviously some very skilled players, but they're just playing the game the right way. And these other teams, I think, are in shock and denial saying, well, God, you know, I'm not going to play this hard. I'm not going to, you know, transition and find shooters and communicate. Do all those silly things that we used to do in high school. That's not being cool and NBA player stuff. So it's kind of fascinating.
It is. And you spoke about it when you're watching Golden State. We had so many years where it was walk the ball up the floor, dump it down in the post, watch one guy go one-on-one. Everyone else stands. Maybe you have a little relocate here and there around the perimeter, and that was it. To see these guys
right.
moving, they run pick-and-roll stuff, but they also run a lot of old-school, basically just motion offense.
Yeah, I enjoy it, and I think most people enjoy it because it's not the old, we're going to isolate somebody and find a mismatch and go one-on-one, and four people stand around facing the court so that somebody can go one-on-one. You know, and that's where I think the popularity of basketball, especially at the NBA level, just started to nosedive, you know?
Yeah.
And now they've gone back to that concept like, you know, Showtime Lakers and the Celtics where nobody worried about stats or who was scoring. It was just, hey, we're going to share the ball and we're going to take more pride in getting an assist than even making our own basket. And that's why I give a lot of credit to, you know, a couple of the NBA coaches that have found a way to push the right buttons, you know, with their players and get them to sacrifice and play as a team and be fundamentally sound. And it's something that I was even skeptical would ever happen again in the NBA. But we're kind of seeing it, you know, the game be reinvigorated by these guys that are willing to play as a team and move the ball and actually make it look like basketball, like we want basketball to look.
Coach, you were known in high school. If I talk to someone that knows that I know you, they'll say the same things. How in the world does he teach his big men what he teaches them? You're known as just this big man guru. But the thing that I think was amazing, not only did you teach the low post presence, because the low, like we talked about, the low post presence has changed. You were able to adapt and still develop big men. How were you able to change that? What were you doing to teach these big men how to play?
You know, I think for some reason, I'm not sure why even it came about, but when I, for some reason, here's this kid from a small town that never saw anybody that was probably over 6'3". You know, if we had a player that was 6'4", 6'5", they were a giant, you know, where I came from and grew up. And we just didn't really deal with big guys because they weren't around much. And I was blessed to have, I mean, I've had a kid that was 7 foot tall that played for me at Greeley Central. I've had a bevy of 6'9", 6'10", 6'11", kids that had been pretty skilled. So for whatever reason, that was my, my flight in life, you know, that was my destiny to coach big kids and have really good big kids. But I think what I developed early, especially with like Pat Garrity, is I was bound and determined not to pigeonhole him into becoming a kid that would run up and down and position themselves at the low block and play with their back to the basket.
Yep.
So my philosophy was as soon as I got a big kid, they were going to learn how to play with point guard skills. They were going to learn to shoot like a two guard. They were going to learn to defend like a three, a good power four. You know, I was going to teach them the entire game. And that was my philosophy. And so, you know, I never subjected big kids to just being a post person. I didn't care how big they were, how slow they were. They were going to learn to bring the ball up against the press. They were going to learn how to pass out of the trap, you know, in full court pressure. You know, they were going to be taught and treated just like the 5'7" kid that you usually get at the high school level that, you know, plays a guard, or sometimes a 5'10" kid that has to play, you know, power forward. It didn't matter to me. They were going to learn all positions, develop a skill set that would allow them to play fast paced, play with the ball, to dribble the ball, pass the ball, do the things that we all do the most in basketball. I wasn't going to just make them someone that caught the ball around the basket and try to, you know, shoot a jump hook or something like that. I just didn't believe in that. And that served me well. I think that's probably one of the things that probably was good about me as a coach, was that if you were a big kid coming in my system, you didn't have to worry about just being someone that was pushed down on the block and that was your entire role in the entire game. You know, you had to defend a point guard in practice. And you know that because you were a big part of my practices and my philosophies. No, you might have to guard someone 5'8" that can shoot a 25-footer, and you're going to learn how to do it, by golly, because we might need you to do that sometime. So that's kind of how I approached it, and I think it paid off in a lot of ways.
Well, and we do our kids such a horrible disservice when you have a kid that's maybe 5'2" in the fourth grade, and we force him down into that block and say, hey, stay down there and don't learn anything else. And then he only gets to be 5'5", and we're wondering why he doesn't have any skill when he gets a little bit older. Yeah, he wasn't growing. He was already done by then. And now this kid doesn't know how to play because we've jammed him down there and told him to shoot jump hooks. Just, it didn't make a lot of sense to me. Okay, so I'm going to make Russ McKinstry the NBA commissioner, and we're going to let you make the rule for when college athletes can come to the NBA. Are you keeping the one and done, or what are you doing with the one and done? What are you going to do with all that?
No, I wouldn't keep the one and done. I hate it. I don't think it's what's best for kids. I think I would make it, Clint, where you could come out after your senior year. You know, if you're that special, LeBron special, or Kobe special,
sure,
Moses Malone special. Otherwise, if you committed to a college, you had to, I would compromise and say, you got to go 2 years. After 2 years, you could become eligible, but you'd have to go at least 2 years. That would be my compromise and the rule I would institute.
Yeah, I'd be going the same way. We're making a mockery of the whole collegiate idea, and we're not really doing these kids any kind of a service. We're not helping these kids as much as they're trying to act like they are. So I would be right there in that same position. Now, Coach, we were talking a little bit about Golden State. Golden State, just ridiculous, the amount of talent and the amount of ability and the way that they play and all those things. I'm going to put you again. I'm going to put you on the spot. You are the head coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers. How in the world would you be trying to defend that group?
Oh my gosh. You know, Kevin Durant was a deal breaker, I think, for the entire league. When that decision was made and he moved over to the Warriors, you know, that made it almost impossible. Not impossible, but almost impossible.
Yep.
You know, you can't slow the game down too much because of the clock and the way the rules are built. But I think if you could find a couple defensive stoppers that were committed to, like I talked about earlier, defensive transition, locating shooters, forcing, you know, people like Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, we'll give you a pull-up mid-range jumper, but you ain't going to get a three tonight. And that takes so much discipline. It takes so much effort, regardless of whatever level you're at. But if you could find maybe two, three guys that you could rotate around and say, hey, you know, you've got to be involved at the offensive end, but really here's what I want you to do. You pick up Steph, you pick up Klay, you pick up Durant at 75-foot mark, and, you know, whatever you have to do, if you get beat on the mid-range or even an attack to the basket, okay, we'll figure that out. We'll live and die by that, but we are not going to give up any three-point looks, nothing open, and see what you could do. You know, I don't know if that would be good enough, to be honest with you, because they're that balanced and they're that talented. What you do is you always try defensively to make them do something that they don't practice every day, whether that's in their offensive scheme or their offensive skill set. So defensively, my job is to teach my players, whatever we do, we're not going to let them do what they're comfortable doing. So if Klay Thompson can beat me off the dribble, take a two dribble, pull up jumper, and beat us all night long, then he's just better than us. But I know he shoots the three extremely well. We're not going to let him do that. Same with Steph.
Sure.
You know, if he wants to do a pull up runner, you know, or a finger roll from 5 feet, and he's making those all night long, and he gets 26 points doing it that way, okay. But we're not going to let him get 40 because he's getting 7 out of 12 three-point looks, you know. We're not going to let him beat us what they do best. And again, it's a player's league at the NBA level. You could do that with high school kids. You can do that probably with college kids because it's still a coach's league. But when you get to the NBA, we all know players make the decision on a lot of times schemes, how hard they're going to play, and very few coaches except for the Popoviches. And I think Steve Kerr falls into that. Have the respect of their players. Okay, coach, we'll buy into that and we'll give it a try. I think that the majority of NBA coaches don't even have the cojones, the brass balls to even mention that type of philosophy to a player because they know they might be embarrassed because the player's going to say, you know, hell no.
Right.
That ain't, I'm not going to work that hard. There's no way. If we get beat, we get beat. I still get my paycheck for $15 million for this month. So I'm not going to work that hard, you know, so. Whatever, I would love to be a fly on the wall, a mouse in the corner with some of these guys like Popovich and Kerr, just to see exactly how they're getting through to these players. And plus, they're extremely talented. So the combination of really high-level coaching with that type of talent, it's really special to watch.
Well, and not only are they talented, like you said, whatever they're saying, they're getting these guys to buy in. And I don't care what system you run. If you can get that team to buy in, everything flips. Everything changes. I know everybody's, you know, down on Phil Jackson and the whole thing with the Knicks. And I completely understand that. They're still trying to run this triangle offense. Yeah, but you know what? If everybody bought in, the triangle would still work because everyone bought into it. It doesn't matter what you run. It matters how hard you run it and how effectively you run it. And we don't always see that. So some of these guys are doing something right.
No, that's a great point. I'm like you. You can run the old flex offense. You can run the triangle. You can run, you know, motion. But as long as you totally believe in it and you get your players to believe in it, that's all that matters. It's not the scheme. It's your belief in the scheme. And if your players believe in it and have confidence in it, then it's like the Broncos with Kubiak. I mean, it was obvious they didn't believe in the scheme. And I didn't either.
I didn't either.
You know, it was painful to watch. It was painful to watch. And, you know, you take one of the premier quarterbacks of all time, Peyton Manning, and you put him behind center and make him look like a fool. And I'm thinking, hey, these guys aren't dummies. I see what's going on. If I can see what's going on, you know they see what's going on.
Yeah.
That this is just an antiquated scheme that isn't fit for our players. And we all know as coaches, you should take your talent and adjust to fit their strengths. And I was really disappointed. And I really respect Gary Kubiak, but when you try and make them fit into your scheme and you don't have the flexibility to take advantage of strengths, then you're doing a really disservice to your players.
Some great NBA teams that we've seen. I'm wondering, in your mind, who are the best NBA teams that you've ever seen?
Well, I'd start really Magic Johnson, Kareem,
yeah.
James Worthy, you know, that bunch, Michael Cooper. If I had to pick one team, I think that stretch of the Lakers were so incredibly special, you know, because arguably you had the best point guard in the history of the game in Magic, and you had the best vibe, you know, the best post in Kareem.
Yep.
And then you had, you know, Hall of Fame people at the wings. You had defensive stoppers. You had depth, you know, and closely followed by Larry Bird's team, you know, with Raquel and Larry Bird, and Dennis Johnson. They were almost the same. I just think the Lakers are a little bit more athletically gifted
yep.
than the Celtics. But, you know, and people argue that maybe the Warriors could be in that same conversation. And I think that's to be determined. I'm not going to rule that out.
Right.
I'm not going to be that old fogey, you know, old school guy and say, no way do they compare it to the Lakers or Michael Jordan's Bulls and that era of basketball. I'm not that far-sighted or nearsighted where everyone calls to just think that, you know, all the glory days were in the past. So we'll see. We'll see what the future holds for the Warriors. And if they can keep the group together, they might be in that conversation. But for now, I'd say Lakers, the Celtics of that generation, you know, Michael and Pippen were special, but I still think the Lakers or the Celtics would beat that group.
Well, they had so much depth.
Yeah, just so
some
much
some of the guys they're bringing off the bench were bona fide, legitimate NBA starters.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, that's why I guess maybe if you were into the present-day NBA, you could kind of say that about the Warriors, you know, with Iguodala, some of the guys they're bringing off the bench. It's kind of that same feeling like, wow, you know, even if their starters get in foul trouble or they go down with an injury, they just reload with talent, you know, Livingston and some of those guys. Just incredibly talented coming off the bench. So,
yeah.
You know, and obviously the Celtics of the 60s would be in the conversation, but then again, there were only, what, 12 or 14 NBA teams then, you know. So
right. No, your bench is stacked then. There's only 60 jobs in the whole league or something.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I think he'd probably be in a conversation, but again, a different type of athlete back in the 60s compared to, you know, the kids that came out that were trained in the weight room and had the advantages of nutrition and weightlifting and special types of conditioning, like started happening, you know, in the 80s and really took off in the 90s.
You know, I know it's popular right now to put LeBron James up there with Michael Jordan. And I understand it. I do. He's such a physically gifted athlete. He really is.
Yep.
I struggle that we've somehow fast forwarded him past some of these other guys. Kareem, like you talked about, Kareem, I can make a case that Kareem is the greatest player in the history of the NBA, not Michael. I can make a case with Magic. And when you look at how many championships he won, how many he went to, and even Larry Bird, I'm not sure I can even get him past those guys. Let alone to go put him at the top of the list. There's a lot of talented players out there that we always, but we love, you know, the flavor of the month. We love who's hot now and he's the greatest I've ever seen. Well, you kind of hopped up on emotion and you're all excited, but I don't know if that's exactly how that would be. Cause if we put Magic in today's game, Kareem in today's game, Michael in today's, it's going to look really, really different, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I would be willing to consider LeBron as maybe the greatest, like you were saying, greatest athlete. Maybe to play the game. You know, he's a beast. He's a freak of nature. But, you know, I always depend on my eyeball, you know, and I've watched basketball at every level, you know, thousands and thousands of games. And, you know, I'd still say Michael, you know, Jordan, Magic Johnson, Kareem, Wilt, Bill Russell, maybe a couple other guys in there during that era too. LeBron, better athlete, but he's not the basketball player those guys are.
Right.
Or were, I guess. You know, that I would give LeBron credit. I think he's getting better. I see him starting to develop some more fluid moves, more sophistication, more intelligence in his game. But still, the eyeball doesn't lie to me. You know,
right.
Michael's better. I would take Larry Bird. If you asked me to draft, you know, all the players ever to play the game, how would I draft him? I would definitely take Kareem. Like you said, I would take Magic. I would take Larry. I'd take Michael. And then I'd start to, then LeBron would be next in the next conversation.
Sure. No, and I completely understand that. It's as an athlete, yes, he's bigger, he's stronger, he's faster. As a basketball player, it's not always there. And that was the one thing.
Right.
When you go back and you watch some of that, you know, you lived watching those games. And I was a little bit young, but I remember watching those games. Some of the people, they've heard about some of those games. So it's different. They didn't get to see Magic and Larry going at each other like we did.
Right. And it's hard to explain to people because what they had that maybe they lacked in athleticism was they had a sixth sense about the game of basketball. They had eyes in the back of their head. They knew things were going to happen before they happened. So they didn't dominate the game with strength and force and vertical jump. They dominated with their mind. And when you watch that kind of basketball, that still, I think, puts you a cut above someone that, you know, like Dominic Wilkins, you know,
right,
who was a freak athlete, but he didn't have the instincts, the court savvy. So Dominic would be a good example of a player from today's era where he's just a freakish athlete.
Sure.
And he dominated because of his athleticism and he had solid basketball skills. But when you take the mind of the Magic, the creativity of a Bird and the feel and technique that Kareem had, you just don't see that very often, if ever anymore. And again, I think that goes back to they played on their own. Games weren't set up for them. So they were playground players and anything was possible. If you could think it, you could dream it, you could try it. Where LeBron is, you know, young enough where he came from the age where, you know, they start playing games with officials and they're, everything's structured for him. And that's what he looks like. You know, he's coming from a structured upbringing and he's just a freakishly good athlete, but he didn't get the opportunity to be on his own, creating games on his own and all the visualization that Magic and Larry did as they were falling in love with the game. I think that's a big part of what the kids lack today is that aspect.
And it's funny that you mentioned that because I know Golden State with Kevin Durant coming over, I understand why they're the villain. I understand why people are cheering against them. They're the big dog. They're the favorite. All these kind of things. When I watch them, though, it is so aesthetically pleasing to see the free-flowing nature to their game. It is open. It is without all the structure of having to be overcoached. You can just see these guys are just reading. They're reacting. They're feeling the game.
Right.
That's kind of the game, I guess, that we grew up with. And so there is part of me that has an affinity for that style of basketball. And because of that, I struggle just hating the Warriors because I love the way they play basketball and they're so unselfish.
Right. No, I agree. I think I hate the fact that now we have a situation where we're so dominated by one team. So it kind of takes the interest because, you know, they're just that good. I mean, what's the point? You know what's going to happen, basically. And you get a certain joy out of watching them play because they're having so much fun. They're playing with passion and they're playing together and there's no agendas and, you know, it's just a really cool thing to watch. But you also want to see someone that can come up and make them earn and compete for what they're going to ultimately try and win. And they're not having to do that. So it kind of takes that my interest level and kind of tempers it just because I don't think there's anybody else that's stepping up to, you know, challenge them. The Cavaliers are trying, but, you know, obviously one, they don't have the talent and the depth. And two, they aren't willing to step to that, out of that comfort zone to even try and work hard enough to compete with.
Yeah, Coach, I cannot thank you enough for coming by and spending like 2 hours here on the Daily Dose. It has been a pleasure talking to you. I've actually learned some things that I didn't know. I appreciate you opening up, sharing a number of things, just talking about your career and some thoughts on basketball, youth sports in general. Such a pleasure to have you on here. You know that you are welcome absolutely anytime.
Well, I appreciate it, and vice versa right back at you. It's been, I can't believe it's been 2 hours of of talk, and I know we could easily go another 2 hours. I always appreciated everything that you've done for me, and I wish you the best with the podcast and everything that you've got going in your career. You're doing a great job. So proud of you, and anytime you want me, you know, just give me a shout. I'd love to talk some more.
Coach, here's the big question I've got. I've got two-part question for you. One, are the Rockies for real? Should we be buying into the shenanigans that they're trying to pass off right now? Because I always feel like the other shoe is going to drop.
One, yeah, you know what? My lips are purple. I've got a purple mustache.
Do
I'm
you?
In the Kool-Aid.
Okay.
I'm all.
Wow, look at you.
only because of their young pitchers.
Yeah.
Only, I don't know, I sense something special going on there. I still have a little trepidation and keep expecting it to all fall apart here in June. But there's something special about those four young pitchers that
right.
maybe will make this a different situation for us.
We talked about it a little bit a few weeks ago, and we were saying, though, even if they do get it right, I'm telling you right now, Coach, I am giving ownership not 1 ounce of credit for getting this right because they've been screwing it up for so many years. They still don't get an attaboy for me. I will fight that.
I can appreciate that, and I concur.
Is Vance Joseph the right guy for the Denver Broncos?
Oh, wow. You know, I'm going to withhold judgment. right now, honestly, I don't think it's been a great start from the things that I hear. And again, I'm not that close to the situation.
Yeah.
And this is just me reading between the lines of talk radio that I listen to every day, probably way too much.
But sure.
I'm a little bit concerned right now with some of the things going on. But I also feel like I think we are blessed, as much as it was cool to win a Super Bowl, that we moved on from Coach Kubiak, that we've got, you know, Mike McCoy, we've
yep.
got Musgrave.
Yep.
I think the assistant coaches might be something that in the end will be the difference of maybe turning this back, going in the direction we were headed, you know, during the Peyton Manning years, and get us back on track.
Okay. Hey, you're making me feel better. I was a little concerned. but I was worried about, you know, the Rockies are just going to go down the toilet any day now. I thought it was happening last week. They lost two or three in a row. I said, oh, here we go. We're starting already. And they've bounced back. They're getting things back together. The Broncos, I know a lot of people are picking them to finish last, go 6-10, this kind of thing. I still think that defense is going to be very, very talented, and it's going to be interesting to see what they can do with their offense and their very young quarterbacks. But you've got me feeling better, so that helps.
Well, that's great because, you know, you and me are probably – the most loyal Bronco fans in the world.
Just morons.
Live and die every Sunday. We are morons. And it's way too important to us. But I'm really hoping that, you know, this fall is better than last fall. And I think you're right. The defense can stay healthy. And we get, you know, maybe some solid play at the quarterback position. We're going to be right there in the hunt.
See, now I've gotten what I've wanted out of you on this interview. You've covered every base here. You've hit every single thing you needed to hit. You've hit all targets. So perfect job coming into the Daily Dose.
Oh, hey, I really enjoyed it, my man. And you have a wonderful night, and give my best to the family.
Just a quick reminder, make sure that you head over to lootcrate.com/Daily Dose. Do any shopping that you might need to do over there. Loot Crate delivers the best in merchandising and collectibles, featuring your favorite TV shows, movies, and video games. And this isn't the knockoff stuff. This is the actual real licensed memorabilia. You can go get a crate, a subscription to crates, or even individual items. The July theme this month is animation, and it features items from Rick and Morty, Bob's Burgers, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and Futurama. Yes, they've got shirts, they've got hoodies, comic books, figurines, hats, even stuff for your pets. You can always go back and you can find past crates, past items from past crates. But the best part about ordering from Loot Crate, when you place your order at checkout, just put Daily Dose in the coupon box. We'll get you 10% off of your order. So there you have it. I genuinely hope that you enjoyed our talk with Coach Mack. We are going to have him back sometime very, very soon. Enjoy getting his thoughts on a number of different subjects. Hey, we are getting into a dry time of year sports-wise. But if you think for 1 second that I'm going to sit here talking baseball all summer, then you must be crazy. We've got a number of shows coming up you do not want to miss. We've got the Daily Dose Dosey Awards. We've got our annual email show that you can contribute to, and we've got much, much more. In fact, next week, we will be handing out our official Daily Dose NBA Season Awards. You know how we do that. We do that Daily Dose style. You do not want to miss as we hand out awards to some of the top players. Well, sometimes some of the top players in the NBA. Plus, after a few weeks off, we will have the return of the Daily Dose Top 5. Yes, folks, it will be coming back next week. Took a couple of weeks off, had the interview with Coach Mack, you know, took a few weeks off from the Daily Dose Top 5, but it will be coming back stronger than ever. If you would like to recommend the podcast, and we would appreciate that so much, please let your friends, your family, your coworkers know. They can subscribe to the podcast pretty much wherever fine podcasts are hosted. Head over to iTunes. They've got it there. Head over to blogtalkradio.com, and they've got every single episode. If you'd like to share the podcast, but you don't really want to talk to people, just click that share button wherever it is that you listen. And you can send your friend or whoever it might be a link to the show. Sometimes that's easier. And if you have someone that's a little bit technically challenged, you'll make it easier for them to listen to the Daily Dose as well. Also, make sure that you stop by our podcast network, RogueIntel.com. The Daily Dose is a proud member of the Rogue Intel Podcast Network, and they've got a number of other podcasts over there that you're going to like, you're going to get addicted to. So go check out a few of the new shows that are up over at RogueIntel.com. Like I said before, if you want to contribute to the email show, we would love to hear from you. Contact us with what's on your mind. You can email us at dailydosesports@gmail.com. That is D-A-L-Y, dailydosesports@gmail.com. Or you can just go find us on Facebook or Twitter and send us a message there. Your message could get read on the email show coming up in a few weeks. Hey, have to say thank you to Russ McKinstry for stopping by, giving us some quality insight into his career and just athletics in general. We appreciate that. Thank you all for listening. I know that we have some great listeners out there. I hear from a number of you. Thank you so much for listening each and every week. It is appreciated. Have to say thank you to JSP. Couldn't do any of this without you. I will see you all next week.
We've been thinking about Lucy.
Wait!
And how she's not very happy that her phone is on its way to Preston without her. And with it, 86 selfies, 4 cat videos, that guy's phone number, and her banking app. But at least she isn't worried about someone stealing her money. That's because at NatWest, we've already thought about the left phone on the train scenario. It's why we never store your bank details on your mobile. NatWest, we are what we do.
App available to customers with online banking and a UK number.